The following show is closed captioned for the reality impaired. The Jerry Bader Show.
Ah, 840, 1360, 97.5, WTAQ, news, talk, sports. We've got the HAL 9000 computer going on from 2001 Space Odyssey. Yeah, that was, I'm sorry, Jason, I can't do that. It was pretty much like that. I don't do the HAL 9000 well. I'm sorry, Dave, I can't comply. That was pretty close. That wasn't bad. Not bad. Daisy. Oh, never mind. I'll have to watch that again. I have not watched 2001 A Space Odyssey in a long time. And it's just, it's amazing how often. By the way, for years, I've told the story. I'm going to quickly digress here. I've got to do this really quickly. I've told the story, the HAL 9000, that Arthur C. Clarke, what he was doing there, the letter in the alphabet that follows H is I, the letter that follows A is B, and the letter that follows L is M, IBM. HAL, H-A-L, IBM. And that was a slap at IBM. Both Stanley Kubrick, producer of the movie, and Arthur C. Clarke adamantly deny that it was merely a coincidence. And they point out that IBM is featured prominently in the movie. So is Pan Am. They're gone now. Just throwing that out. Okay. I Googled it recently because I've been curious about it. Both Kubrick, the director, I said producer, director of the movie, and Arthur C. Clarke adamantly deny that HAL is code for IBM. All right. It's a hell of a coincidence, isn't it? That IBM follows H-A-L. Of course, then what would the 9000 be? By the way, HAL was born in 1997, according to that. We've got a lot of stuff to get to on the show today, including our update in just a minute here with Congressman Reid Ribble. A lot of developments in Washington yesterday. We're doing this every day with Reid until it's resolved. I quickly, though, want to give a huge attaboy to the Green Bay Police Department. Do you recall a couple of weeks ago, a couple of guys were stopped by Appleton police in their downtown farmers market on a Saturday? The guys had long guns slung over their shoulders. They were drawn upon. They were detained for quite a while. Police took their legally concealed handguns, ran a check on them, said, this isn't going to appear on YouTube. Ha ha. What I said at the time, I disagreed with what the guys were doing. They're walking downtown with guns just to make a point. On the other hand, I felt the police overreacted in drawing on them. That was my position on that. Same thing happened yesterday in downtown Green Bay. Two men openly carrying an assault rifle and a shotgun were stopped by police Tuesday afternoon around 2 p.m. They were questioned and sent along their way. They weren't detained. There was no this, no that. Police determined they were legally carrying the long guns, as open carry is legal in Wisconsin, and that was that. If you're doing it just to prove a point, I have a problem with that. However, I believe the Green Bay police handled this appropriately. However, the Green Bay paper goes out of its way to point out that the AR-15 is the same type of gun used in the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown and the movie theater shootings in Aurora, Colorado. So what? Green Bay police, I think, handled this. Everything was checked out, and they were okay to go. I think the Appleton police overreacted. I think Green Bay police got it exactly right. Might say more on that at some point later in the show or later this week. However, as I said, a lot of activity continuing to go on in Washington with what has morphed from defund Obamacare to government shutdown, to government shutdown and debt ceiling and budget and entitlement reform. To talk about all of that now and the latest on it is 8th District Congressman Reed Ribble joining us on the phone, as he does every day through this. Reed, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Jerry. Wow, you summarized that. You summarized it perfectly.
Yeah.
This is where it's going.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly what happened. I've got to start with a chuckle, though, Reed.
Yeah.
I'm 52 years old. I've been in news and then talk radio for 30 years. I didn't think I would ever see this headline. Poll. Voters prefer hemorrhoids over Congress.
In many respects, I don't blame them.
You know what that means? You're not even their favorite pain in the ass.
Well, okay. In that case, maybe I've moved up. I don't know.
This is from USA Today.
Yeah.
It's no surprise these days Congress isn't very popular. Let's see if I can do this with a straight face.
Yeah.
But a new poll says voters have a higher opinion of witches, hemorrhoids, and jury duty than lawmakers in Washington. And now to the serious side, you're not surprised.
No, I'm not surprised by it. However, I do think that in many respects that members of Congress, because we have a tendency to beat ourselves up and beat each other up, play into the ongoing dialogue. You know, there are some members of Congress that I've come to know and have great respect for. These are men and women with a profound level of integrity that are trying to do the right thing. And then there are some that are just here to be somebody. But there's more good people here than when I was first running would have believed it to be the case. But we also have a situation here now where we have to recognize, and this is really where the point I wanted to make today with the listeners, is that, in my opinion, not only is this morphed into the broader discussion about the debt limit, it's morphed into the broader discussion about separation of powers.
Yeah.
And this really is where it's at. Does the president get to just arbitrarily change legislation, fix laws that in the way that he wants them to do? You know, he keeps talking about the Obamacare being settled law, and yet he changes it by executive fiat, but doesn't want the Congress of the United States as the representative voice of the people to change it.
That's not getting said often enough. Now, I've heard others say it, but you are absolutely right. Where the notion that it's Congress that is somehow overreaching and simply wanting to legislatively change what has happened with Obamacare, he's done it literally at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, he just does it on a whim to protect his own reputation, and it's a fascinating debate about democracy right now. And one of the concerns that is now being quietly voiced around Washington is, will the president exercise what he believes is a 14th Amendment right to raise the nation's debt limit to authorize the payment of bills? And that would be a breach of the executive power, like almost like anything we've seen in our lifetime.
There is serious discussion now, huh, that he is considering unilaterally doing that?
That's a concern.
What in the world would the congressional response to that be?
Well, it's a difficult thing to say because it's never happened before. Now, the president came out a few weeks ago saying he doesn't believe he's got the power, but I'll guarantee you at 2 in the morning, if you go past that deadline, he probably would do it. And that's why we have to figure out a way to break the logjam, get people to the table, and actually find a path forward. And I think that what is most likely to happen, based on what I'm hearing today, is that there'll be some type of very short-term movement on the debt limit and funding of the government to put people back to work, with another hard deadline on the debt limit requiring then the negotiation to occur. And so the president will say to the people he won, because he wasn't brought to the negotiating table with a gun to his head. But on the other hand, Republicans will say, well, we won because the gun is still there 3 weeks from now. And you're trying to find a way that both sides can save face. And now it's more about that than it is about doing what's right for the American people.
Talking with Congressman Reed Ribble, well, you and I talked about this yesterday. So if you do the short-term thing, now it looks like he would actually negotiate in that period, because, again, yesterday he said he won't.
Yeah, well, but basically he said he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it right now, but he's sending little indicators that he wants a short-term extension. Now, Harry Reid is out there saying, we're not taking a short-term extension. We want to get past the 2014 elections. Now, big surprise there, right?
Right.
But the fact that the president is kind of putting out this little tiny olive branch that he might actually be willing to come to the negotiating table if we got past the immediate. I view that as a bit of a positive sign.
Talking with Congressman Reed Ribble, as I'm sure you're aware, your Wisconsin colleague Paul Ryan has a piece
in the Wall Street Journal today.
In the Wall Street Journal, yeah. And I want to hit two things on this. And we got about 5 minutes. I should be able to do both. I want to start with where he starts. The president is giving Congress the silent treatment. He's refusing to talk, even though the federal government is about to hit the debt ceiling, and that he will not negotiate. He claims such negotiations would be unprecedented, and then I'll let you pick that up. As Paul points out, that's nonsense.
Well, of course it's nonsense. Since 1978, the debt ceiling has gone up, I think, 53 times. 26 times, it has been centered around a major reform. And the most precarious one was when Democrats did it back in 1978, and they went up to like 6 hours before the debt limit was reached. And so this has always happened, and this president has negotiated twice with this Congress. We got the Budget Control Act in 2011, and we got No Budget, No Pay in 2013.
Let me read a couple of paragraphs here. If Mr. Obama does decide to talk, he'll find that we actually agree on some things. For example, most of us agree that gradual, structural reforms are better than sudden, arbitrary cuts. From my Democratic colleagues, the discretionary spending levels in the Budget Control Act are a major concern. Truth is, there's a better way to cut spending. We could provide relief from the discretionary spending levels in the Budget Control Act in exchange for structural reforms to entitlement programs. Here are just a few ideas to get the conversation started. We could ask the better off to pay higher premiums for Medicare. We could reform Medigap plans to encourage efficiency and reduce costs. And we could ask federal employees to contribute more to their own retirement. These do seem like solid negotiating starting points.
Yeah, they certainly are. And I would add to that, and I made this case very strongly yesterday, that whatever we do must capture the imagination of the American people. And so it has to be big enough that they can understand it. It has to be big enough that they can really see that there's movement here, but it also has to capture them right where they live. And so I've been making the case on entitlement reform that we ought to begin to pull the levers on Social Security. And as Paul rightly states, that Social Security is a big number. Social Security's actuaries say that if we reform it, we could save $4.6 trillion. I offered up a reform that would save $9.6 trillion. And so there are ways that we could actually do something that would capture the imagination of the American people and fix it. And imagine a 22-year-old college kid who's typically voting for a Democrat who says, well, I'm never going to get Social Security anyway, actually saying, well, wow, Republicans fixed this for me. You know?
Yeah, and now the question is, will as you look at this short-term extension, are Democrats and President Obama serious about the, and this is what you told us about last week, comprehensive entitlement reform?
Well, I think some of them are. And remember, what you need here is some people in the Congress to prevail. You need 218 votes, and that could be a mix of both sides. There certainly are. I've had a lot of conversations lately on Social Security where many Democrats have said to me that they want to fix it. Now, you know, in Paul's op-ed, he talked about asking federal employees to contribute more to their own retirement. I think that that's a non-starter for the Dems, just to be honest with you. I don't see them doing it, and I'll tell you why. Because federal pay has been frozen for 4 years now, and they're not going to say, well, we're not going to freeze their pay and make them pay more for their own retirement plan.
Okay.
I just don't see that as a very strong negotiating point. But these other options on Medicare, these are big numbers. I mean, this gets to be really, really big when you start looking at the out years.
I have a question from a listener that I want to throw by you. I got this shortly before before I came on the air at 8:30. Can you please tell me if this is true? The government default would not result in the government, quote unquote, not paying its bills. The government has enough daily income from taxes and other fees to cover the payments. It only stops the government from incurring new debt and affects our credit for future debt.
It's not even remotely close.
Okay.
We had deficit spending of about $700 billion this year. It was $1.5 trillion or so when I came into Congress, so it's been cut in half. But if you have a deficit of $700 billion, what is that? That equals, what, $57 or $60 billion a month?
Mm-hmm.
That's the shortfall. That's how many bills won't get paid. Okay. And so it would be a real problem. And the other thing is, by October 17th, when we actually hit the debt limit, the Treasury is telling us the actual cash on hand will only be about $2 billion left. So they've exhausted everything. And then there are, you've got Social Security payments that need to be made in the middle of the month, Medicare payments that got to be made, and then you also have to renew bonds and everything. It would be a real, it'd be a nightmare. I just don't see how you can go past it.
Talking with Congressman Reed Ribble. Reed, we have about a minute, but I did want to get you to comment on this.
Mm-hmm.
The government shutdown denying an array of financial benefits to families of troops killed in combat training or other causes in the military. In addition, services to veterans were further curtailed Tuesday as the Veterans Affairs Department exhausted some carryover funds and furloughed 7,000 workers. But and I heard about this yesterday. There's a story in Wisconsin where a family of a fallen Wisconsin soldier can't go to basically pick him up because of funds that are normally allocated for that.
Yeah, and by the way, there's plenty of money that to meet these needs. In fact, Secretary Hagel just pulled back 350,000 or so civilian furloughed Department of Defense people. This is one of these political one-upsmanships to make things hard. I think it's a mistake by the administration to draw this line. Now, back in July, we sent over to the Senate a full appropriations for MILCON and VA. It's military construction and VA to fully fund it through the typical appropriations process. And so this there's no reason that we're at this spot with veterans at all. Department of Defense was fully funded back in July with a full appropriations bill, and the Senate hasn't even brought them up. So today we're going to pass H.J. Res 91, which will honor the families of fallen soldiers. We're going to make sure that those things are taken care of. We're going to pass it today.
All right, Congressman Reed Ribble, we are plumb out of time, but we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Great. Thanks, Jerry.
Yep, 8th District Congressman Reed Ribble, and we'll get to more. Again, we'll continue to do that with Reed. Until the situation is resolved. And by the way, our daily updates with Reed Ribble from Washington, brought to you by Dual Financial Strategies, 857.